Hi everyone, welcome to the next talk in the Obstetrics and Gynecology Patient Blood Management mini tutorial series, which is on intravenous iron. We're going to briefly cover the basics of intravenous iron, what you should know, how it works, and the pharmacology, adverse effects, and how to talk to a patient about it and get consent. So let's get on with it. So the first thing you need to know is just a little bit of basic pharmacology. You can't infuse intravenous iron in an unbound form. It is highly toxic. It oxidizes molecules, and therefore it is always infused as a colloid and encapsulated in a large molecule like a spheroidal carbohydrate. This is the same way that the human body manages iron as well. As you know, ferritin and transferrin are large protein molecules which encapsulate the iron to prevent it from causing any damage. Many of the pharmacological variations that you find with these different intravenous iron preparations are due to the differences in the properties of this encapsulating molecule, of the carbohydrate. Very basically, there's a wide range of different preparations around the world. There's only a few in Australia, and we'll go over those in a second. Basics are that the high molecular weight molecules bind the iron quite tightly, meaning that there is little free iron released, and you can give the patient the total dose of iron that they need in one infusion. Other preparations have smaller molecules surrounding the iron, which means there is some free iron released, limiting the total dose you can give during each infusion, and usually means that patients have to come back for more than one infusion, so they're not used that often anymore in Australia. Let's just briefly discuss again who should we consider intravenous iron for. The huge majority of them fall into these two categories. One, where you need a rapid effect, so oral iron will work in some patients, but it usually takes a couple of months to fully replete everything. Or even longer. So if you need an effect quicker than that, then intravenous iron will do things a bit quicker, usually a couple of weeks. Some patients obviously cannot tolerate oral iron due to side effects. They may have a psychosocial situation where compliance over a long period of time is unlikely to be accomplished. So those patients may benefit from intravenous iron, and certainly patients who have a high hepcidin state or an inflammatory condition, the iron that is taken orally is sometimes not transferred into the body. Please refer back to the iron physiology talk, where we go over hepcidin and ferroportin and explain this. So basically, high levels of hepcidin decrease the amount of ferroportin, which means that the iron from the gut is not transported across into the body, and so it's not absorbed. These are patients with inflammatory conditions, post-surgery, cancer, renal impairment, etc. All right, formulations in Australia. There are three available, although only two that are commonly used. The most commonly used and the one that's been around the longest is iron polymaltose. When it was first introduced in the 60s, it was primarily given intramuscularly, and that's why they come as small 100 milligram ampules, which makes it a bit of a pain to draw up the 1,000 to 1,500 milligrams when you give it as an infusion. Traditionally, it was given over 5 hours, but much more common nowadays in most units or hospitals and institutions around Australia to be given over 60 to 90 minutes. And we did a study in 100 gynecology patients where it was given in theatre over 15 minutes, showing there was no real problem giving it over that period of time, similar to the same sort of speed in which carboxymaltose is given. Main advantage is that it is fairly well tolerated, with very low incidence of side effects, and it's very cheap, approximately $40 for 1,000 milligrams in most hospitals. Iron carboxymaltose, a similar preparation in that it is a large molecule and you can give pretty close to a total dose infusion of about 1,000 milligrams. It's been around for about 5 or 6 years now in Australia, although longer in parts of Europe. It is licensed to be given over 15 to 30 minutes to people who come and sit in the outpatient infusion clinics, and that is the reason why it is used for the majority of those patients in most units. It is approximately $300 for 1,000 milligrams, so about 10 times more expensive, although with PBS funding from the federal government, that makes that much less of an issue nowadays. Finally, just mentioning iron sucrose, which is a very well studied preparation, which has been around a long time, is thought to be incredibly safe. Unfortunately, you can only give smaller doses, so most people need recurrent doses, you know, sometimes up to 3 to 6 infusions, so it's not used very often anymore. But was the traditional one used when other people, when they had no allergy to polymaltose. All right, adverse effects and toxicity. So talk about mainly the infusion reactions. There are some delayed reactions, which we'll talk about later. So the things that people worry about, obviously, when they're discussing intravenous iron and consenting a patient to it, is anaphylaxis. So what is the real incidence of a serious life-threatening anaphylactic reaction? There's a little bit of an association in people's minds of anaphylaxis with intravenous iron, and most of that is because of the old preparation, which is no longer available in Australasia, of iron dextran, which did have a high incidence of anaphylaxis. The modern ones, which I've just described to you, now are thought to be very safe in this respect, and although they're not, the risk of hypersensitivity reaction is not zero, it is very low. Have a look at this paper from the British Journal of Pharmacology, published very recently. It talks about hypersensitivity reactions to intravenous iron and it compares it to other common drugs. You'll see that the high-risk drugs, and this is classified as where the risk of a serious reaction is 1 to 10%, includes something like penicillin, which is administered quite liberally in labour ward in many places. And some other immunoglobulin treatments, whereas the intravenous iron preparations that are used around the world now are thought to fall into the low or very low category, and these are so they're thought to be very safe. So when talking to a patient, I certainly say to them, you know, the chance of a serious adverse reaction to intravenous iron is much less than penicillin and much less than blood, where there is quite a high incidence of things like pulmonary edema from Tarco and Traley, hemolytic reactions, febrile reactions, etc. Important adverse event, which is important that you mention when you're talking to patients, is the risk of extravasation. So if any of the intravenous iron preparation enters the tissues from an IV cannula that is leaking, it can cause serious semi-permanent staining of the skin. I have seen a couple of patients who on follow-up told me they, and a couple of years down the track, most of the stain had gone, but certainly this is a pretty serious event. It's important to make sure, if you're involved in the administration of intravenous iron, that you check the cannula with a clear solution like saline or something like that first. Make sure it's not leaking, there's no pain, and there is therefore much less likelihood of this event occurring. But it is important to mention it to patients. Fishbane reaction is also another acute reaction, which is very rare, but it is described in the literature, and I've seen it a few times. Named after Dr. Fishbane, if you're wondering where that name's from. He was a nephrologist in the North America who published it in a journal. And basically it's an acute pain in your chest or back during an infusion. It's thought to be a musculoskeletal reaction. But it can be quite distressing to patients and staff who are administering the infusions. You know, a pain in the chest is often a concerning symptom. Usually, the treatment involves ceasing the infusion. It usually stops. It's not a complete contraindication to continuing the infusion, because a few times we have continued it afterwards and it hasn't recurred. But you should certainly think twice about that and evaluate the necessity for them to have the intravenous iron. It's not thought to be a hypersensitivity type reaction, so it's unclear exactly what the mechanism is, though. Common adverse effects. So these can occur during the infusion, but often for the next couple of days after an infusion, so it's important to let people know that these can occur. Patients can just feel generally a bit flu-like. They have myalgia, feel maybe a bit of nausea, a bit of headache, metallic taste, rash. All of these things can occur. Most of the time, it's pretty mild in response to sort of rest and a bit of Panadol, that sort of thing. There might be some evidence that corticosteroids ameliorate this a little somewhat, so although that hasn't been well studied. Now, this is important. Cautions and contraindications. So, there is theoretical and probably some actual evidence that iron, and certainly intravenous iron, can support the growth of bacteria, both in vitro and in vivo. So it is sensible to avoid giving intravenous iron infusion to someone who has a active bacterial infection. And if they do need the intravenous iron because they can't tolerate, for example, oral iron, it'd be more sensible to schedule that at a later date when the concerns regarding the infection have resolved. It's not an absolute contraindication, obviously, but there may be some life-threatening situations where people who refuse blood products, for example, might be the benefit overweighs the risk. But I think in general you should always avoid it. Definitely, first trimester of pregnancy, like most medications, you should try and avoid asthma. This is a caution. Many asthmatics who don't have, strong history of drug reactions and are nice and stable have had intravenous iron and doesn't seem to be any problems, and there's a bit of literature on that, but all these other things that are listed here are listed on the cautions in the drug insert, and you should be careful about using it in people with active autoimmune disease, active inflammatory renal and liver disease. All of these are cautions. In fact, most people with chronic renal impairment get intravenous iron as part of their erythropoietin therapy. Acute blood loss. Just want to briefly mention this. I'm not going to go into great detail, but there are about 11 studies now looking at the use of intravenous iron for the treatment of postpartum anemia. And many of them use blood loss as their inclusion criteria, including this really recent one published this year. Have a read of it. They showed that there was a superior patient-centered outcomes, including fatigue and laboratory parameters, which are not the primary outcome. And so just remember, cast your mind back to the physiology talk, that most of the iron in your body is in your blood. If you lose a large volume of blood during childbirth, then you have an acute iron loss. So that's the theory behind that, and that's the reason why this has been studied in that population. Final slide. This is just to pique your interest, but intravenous iron is used for a range of other things, including heart failure. There's some evidence that it improves myocardial function, and it's used in functional iron deficiency, where in particular patients who are on erythropoietin. All right. I hope you found that useful. Gives you a good mental model about how to frame when intravenous iron should be used, how you should discuss it when consenting a patient. Next up, we're going to talk about intrapartum and intraoperative strategies to minimise blood loss. Hopefully, you'll find that useful as well. So thanks for listening, and see you again next time. Okay.